I was wasting my time. You sound better than this, don't you?
Okay.
I'll keep doing it. By the way, we are in totally this version of the Court of Ghosts. I took a look at my stuff and we've never done chapters 11 and 12 before. 9 we have done, but 10 we have not. And there are some great tricks. Basically, what is in chapters 10, 11, and 12 are really useful techniques for doing a lot of things. You know, you did the low-level image processing algorithm in earlier classes, or in the earlier chapters. What we really want to do now is use them for things. Bill.
Yeah, a warning for the first data set.
You have the same problem with most Mac software as well. And in fact, I wondered what was going on when the first time I only got like 300 images or 900 images in my movies. And it's because if you take a look at the way Scott labeled, I think Scott actually drove DD, but I'm not sure. But if you take a look, they have leading blanks and stuff, and that can really mess up your software. So you may want to look very carefully at the names, or if someone really does rename everything. I was just too lazy to write a script. But if someone renames everything, I'll be happy to, you know, do another round of disk on my computer. Okay. Oh, and those of you who are doing things which are a little bit different, that we don't have enough images in the data set. Stop signs, traffic lights, maybe other vehicles, grass. As I look at everything, it seems like we have an exceptionally large amount of asphalt or concrete. We really don't have much grass. So if you want to get other pictures offline, or rather from online, that's fine. Probably, though, remember, one of the things is testing your algorithm. You're probably going to need at least 100 images to do it. Now, there's snow on the ground out there, but traffic lights are still red, green. I was going to say red, green, blue. red, green, yellow. And stop signs are normally red, but the Friedman Lab over in the library. Apparently you can go in and just with your ID sign out still cameras, movie cameras. They only have a couple, but you can do that over in the library. So if you need to, you know, just walk around campus and take pictures of traffic lights and stop signs. You could also do pictures of probably orange barrels. Robert's not here. Okay. You know, he's working on Roberto. He wants to instill emotions into the robot. So the idea is every time it sees an orange barrel, it will get angry. For those of you who aren't a driver, usually orange barrels are associated with frustration. Okay. So any questions about anything you need other than your graded papers? That is, your long evaluations from me. Yes?
So when we're writing our to what degree are we allowed to talk about things that were tried and maybe
tried by whom?
By us.
I'm not quite clear. I know what you mean. I think you're saying, okay, you have an idea, and suppose it doesn't work very well, but you're going to write it up and submit it anyway. Is that right?
More or less. At least it's part of it. I mean, not that everything hasn't worked, but there are things that haven't worked. Suppose you have five ideas, four don't work in the lesson, but you want to hear about the other four?
That depends. If one of the things that you could, there's an easy way to do this, you know. Okay. You know, how do people make bad research look good? Okay. Obviously, what you're going to do is publish a paper on five algorithms and compare them. Very good research. Excellent. Most people don't spend that much time on things that don't work. But let's be honest. What one of the very important things is can you speculate why they don't work? Okay. Remember, there is a section at the end. You haven't written a thesis yet, probably. But you're hoping to. And one of the project. Okay. But one of the things that you always have to do is you have a discussion and results section. And one of the things would be that you would put in a situation like that, here are four or five algorithms, you compare them. That is very important research. But the best thing, which is what we always look for when we read your theses and dissertations, is that you actually understand why. If you have no idea why, okay, then maybe you shouldn't mention it. But if you can, with some type of reasonable engineering, scientific, or mathematical argument, say, here's why I think it didn't work. That's appropriate. That is important. And take a look at the file of papers that I put online. It's on the home page for the course, right below the description of the midterm and final grading, and it says student papers. And watch out for your browser. I use Firefox, and for some reason, it always caches that page. So I never saw, unless I manually reloaded it. But in the middle, it'll say student papers, and then right below it, it'll say a complete file of this year's midterm projects. And that has a hyperlink that you can click on. First of all, it needs the class account and password. And then the account or the file itself has a password. And anyone that didn't submit a midterm project doesn't get a password. Yet. Okay, just checking who's here. So if you haven't submitted a midterm project, I think everyone here did. No. Read your email. Oh, to download the file, it's the same one that we've always used. You know, EECS 490 Roberts. But there's additional for the file. Okay? Any other questions? But yes, if you can explain why something didn't work. Now, that doesn't mean that you should pick something that you know in advance has no chance of working to make your stuff look better. That's pushing it. Okay. But if you did a good, if you, you know, formulated the algorithm, you had reason to believe it would work, it would fail, and you can analyze and say, here's why it did fail. Then that's very reasonable work. As long as you have one good one. And one of the things is how well do they work. Being able to do five and compare them and say, here's what I want to use and why, that's pretty useful work. Okay, let's finish up chapter 10. Then I'm going to try and finish up chapter 11 today. And I'm ready to go into chapter 12 as well, but I think that's wishful thinking. Okay. We did this the last time. The key thing in this chapter is it's all about segmentation. And what that means is what we did back, way back when we introduced the idea of segmentation. We simply said, okay, maybe if it's close to this color in an RGB color space, that's part of the object. Well, that only is part of the whole segmentation. The key thing is what we saw first in Chapter 9. Actually, we did it before that, but in Chapter 9, we dealt with sets that were typically connected. Okay, typically, the way you segment is things are connected. By that, they can be lines. Okay? In essence, what your Huff transform is doing, in some sense, is it's finding a line which connects a lot of points. Now, that's not quite the same as what we've been doing in this chapter. What we've been doing in this chapter is typically we have direct connectivity. And usually, it could be four connectivity, north, south, east, west, those four pixels. So if this one is the right color, and this is the pixel that I'm considering, the color has to be within the threshold, okay, and it has to be connected. If there's a blank pixel in between, that's not connected. We wouldn't segment them to the same object. And we're going to talk about that some more in some of the pictures. Okay, this was the one that we were talking about the last time. This is a weld. We actually were doing it back when we did pseudocolor. This one is a weld. All we did is we picked the pixels which were the brightest. You could pick a color. Doesn't matter. The point is we picked some characteristic. That's usually what we use to form what we call seeds. That's usually where we start growing a region from. You can do similar techniques with lines, but these are regions. So what we would then be doing is starting with these pixels, we'd be applying this kind of analysis and saying, okay, are two adjacent connected pixels within a certain tolerance of grayscale of each other? So you see, basically, I could have something like this. If I would be going across and my grayscale kept going down, there's two ways that you can connect things. One is that if this is my kernel or my seed, I use that reference grayscale. And then I simply say that G of XY minus G ref, or GC, that would be better, is less than some threshold, then they're connected if they're adjacent. So you see, that's an absolute, and it would grow out. They used an absolute here. What you can also do is you can use a relative. Or something like that, saying, okay, I'm here, and if this pixel has a difference which is less than some threshold, then that's connected together. You get into interesting issues which we did not talk about if, for example, maybe it's those three. But I talked about them early on in a lecture, and I called it blob coloring. Basically, all of a sudden, is this might be an object that we're growing down, this might be an object we're growing across. They meet at some point, and we say they're equivalent. That is, they're the same object. That's all. Okay. I found the chalk dust really messes up my trackpad. Okay, so that's what happened here. And you can see it didn't have an awesome effect. But what it did do is basically it filled out and extended the cracks. They're light on a darker background. You pick the threshold appropriately for the differences, whether they be absolute or relative. And then what we did with this is we ran a gradient operator over it to just get the edges. Now, you could have done something different, like use the boundary operation from Chapter 9, you know, where you erode the object and then subtract it from the original object. There's all kinds of ways of doing it. So we put the boundaries on top. And depending on your application, you might be more interested in the areas or in the boundaries. Now, why did I talk about this and do it and how we did it? The reason is, I was talking last time about what happens. Remember, we were looking at an object that we illuminated with non-uniform light and it mushed up the thresholds, or it smeared the histogram together. Originally, it had two nice peaks, but due to the lighting at an angle, smeared everything together. What happens in those situations is you can't use simple thresholds. And if you think about it, you've got oblique lighting in almost every one of your CARS videos. You know, it's difficult. And you're faced with it here. Look at that. Where would you put your threshold? All we did in the previous image is we got the seeds here. These didn't necessarily use knowledge of the histogram. So basically, we probably just picked these brightest ones right here and then grew backwards. And we decided to stop not by a threshold by itself, but by whether they're connected and have a big change. Whoops. There would obviously be a large change in gray level, which would exceed our threshold at the edges. That's usually what we do with region growing. It can occur with lines as well. Now, another technique, split merge. This is a one variant split merge. There's a whole lot of varieties of split merge, but this one is fairly simple. Take an image and let's just start splitting it into quads. And each quad can go to as fine a resolution as you set a limit. It could go down. The key idea is you go down as far in this splitting into regions until the contents of each region are uniform. So it might be that you might have something like this. And you would then just start splitting. You see, the first quadrant that I made wasn't very uniform. This would be maybe black and that's white, or vice versa. Okay? Not very uniform. And there's all kinds of measures of uniformity you could use. One of the obvious ones, what's the variance? It could be a statistical thing. Or you could just take a look at a histogram and say, what are the extremes? But there's all kinds of ways. But what we're simply looking for is homogeneity within a region. And you can see, obviously, these are very homogeneous. That would be one region right there. And we might even argue that one's homogeneous, that one's homogeneous. And these, we might split some more. But basically, you set a threshold for how far, that is how fine, you split the image up. That's the splitting. The merging is, you go down as far as you can, then you start looking around you. For example, if those are white, then what we would do is we would link or merge this region with these two, possibly with these three, because they would have A, connectivity. They're adjacent to each other. B, the same characteristics, just like this. They're within some tolerance of each other. But this is basically, go as fine a granularity in the image as you set in advance, and then basically on the way back up, combine the ones together. You get into more and more data structures as you get into more and more types of image processing. Here actually is a result of split merge using a leaf with a stem. And by the way, notice that it actually kept a little bit of the stem. Simple thresholding lost it entirely. So depending on how fine grain you're willing to go, you can actually keep some of the details. Okay, something from chapter 9. This is something called a watershed algorithm. It's used for segmentation. And it's actually pretty interesting. Okay, by the way, there are routines to do this. This is the original grayscale image. Okay. Then the first thing that we do is we sort of plot it in perspective. So we're plotting the grayscales so that they look like mountains. Okay, so as this is getting brighter, and you can see it's lighter on that side, darker. So what we're doing is when you see structures like this, and about when you implement an algorithm, a lot of you do that in a project. Basically, this stuff builds up and down, and some are higher than others. Okay, what the whole fundamental idea of the watershed algorithm is, imagine that they really are like mountains, okay, and valleys. And think of this as maybe done on a surface, okay, and I have access to the bottom. I'm going to come around to all of the lowest points. You know, this will be the bottom of the valleys. I'm going to punch a hole in the bottom and fill up this water. That's effectively what the watershed algorithm is doing. It's saying, basically, if I would start filling up the bottom with water, all of the area that's covered by water would be the same object. Okay? That would be a region. And you notice it can handle hills in the middle. It's pretty good at finding connected algorithms or finding connected objects. Now, what happens? Basically, we punch it, we fill it up, and what mathematically is that we did in Chapter 9? Well, it would roughly correspond to doing a dilation. You start with your seed object at the lowest point, and you start dilating. You keep dilating. Okay? And you put conditions on it. Okay? Each time it keeps adding a pixel to it, it keeps filling up. However, we put a conditional dilation. When they hit each other, in other words, as we're coming up this little hill here, this little mountain range, eventually there's going to be one pixel right between them. Maybe not at each point at the same time, because this is going to be different heights as you go along. But what happens, we've done conditional dilation before. When the two dilations hit each other, they mark that point as a dam, and stop, and you just keep dilating. The idea is, starting from the seeds, You dilate until you build dams. You stop when there's no more change in the picture. So basically, you can see what's happening. All of these heights are going away. They're being replaced by single pixel dams. You see, this isn't complete yet. And what happens when you're done is you get nothing but a line everywhere. This, by the way, is simply the dams, the regions between the boundary, or the boundaries between the regions, indicated on top of the original image. So this is actually a very powerful algorithm. It's got the connectivity topology built right in. The one thing is that with complex images, you're going to get an awful large number of regions. And by the way, one person did do a watershed algorithm for their midterm, and I don't remember. Who was it? Someone here? Someone did. I can't remember. Oh, this just shows all the details. This is showing two of the sections that we're flooding. We condition, we dilate. That means expanding. We keep adding one pixel at a time with a very simple structuring element. And what happens here is when the two meet, that's where we construct the dam. So really neat algorithm. I don't know if you can use that in your 591, but it's a really neat algorithm. And this is what happens when you use it on some stuff. This is the original image. Construct the gradient, and then apply the watershed to the gradient. And that did a pretty nice job of finding all of the regions. You know, you could look at that and say, yeah, that looks about right. Very good for automatically segmenting complex objects like that. Here's one. How would you like to have done that one? Now, this would be a good candidate for a split merge. As they say, over-segmentation is evident. If you have a really, really complex surface, the algorithm doesn't work very well. Things that it probably doesn't work really well on, shrubbery, bushes, natural vegetation. There's too much detail. What you'd have to do, and you couldn't do it here, you see, this looks like it's already been low-pass filtered. It's just that there's too much detail. You really should do something different or merge a lot of the similar objects there. Now, that one's a little bit better. Okay. Now, something that's probably nearer to some of the things that you're doing is, how about if we have moving objects in a series of images? Okay. These are known as accumulative difference images. And there's really not too much to them. Basically, we take two images from the same camera, different instance in time, and actually, it's a little bit like a Huff accumulator. You have an accumulator, but what happens is we increment each pixel in the accumulator if we detect a difference between two frames in a sequence. So in other words, I might have a sequence of images, maybe four of them or whatever. Maybe there's a moving object, like in that case, it's a rectangle, and it moves over and down. And basically, the first way you can do it is you can say, okay, let's just simply increment the accumulator XY, and what the sub K means is we've gotten up to K images. So like 1, 2, 3, 4 would be up, K would then be 4. So this would be the result of 4 different images. And you can almost look at it and count it. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, looks like 10. About 10 different images that we've accumulated. And we simply increment the accumulator, the previous value, plus 1, if the difference between the images is greater than a threshold. RXY is the reference. The reference is usually the first image. Any one of these, now, these are the f of xy. And technically, there's a k in there. This is k. Okay. And actually, we'd really probably start at 0 and then do each one after that. But we always have a reference. Then we look at this and say, okay, I look at that pixel. If the difference in gray levels or in color between the two is going to be greater than a threshold, then increment the accumulator. So it is a little bit like a huff in the sense that you've got an accumulator, and all it's showing is accumulated differences. Okay? And you can do positive differences and negative differences. Because you see right here, I took the absolute value. I could, for a positive difference, simply require no absolute values be greater than a threshold, or I could flip it around. And that's what we have here. This is an absolute, there's a positive, there's a negative. This can help you find moving objects. You can do things with them. Here's a very classic difference image. And I mean, a lot of you did difference images early on, and I think it was Project 2. But here's a very classic one. Lots of cars, busy street. This car. Okay. Remove it. You have enough information, okay, with the image accumulator, okay, all you have to do is go find images in which no differences occurred and paste them in later ones. You've got the information there. It's a great part of the image. This is how you can do simple special effects. Now, here's actually, I think, one of the coolest techniques in the chat. This is one that someone was really clever about. There's an image right here. And there's actually a really tiny moving object, and I'm not even 100% sure I remember where it is. Someplace in here. It's very, very weak. Very poor. It's a light gray, and it's small, and you can barely see it. And I'm going to show you an image processing technique for finding moving objects in images, which is based on Fourier transforms. And it's really cool. The basic concept is just imagine something this simple. We're going to have an object, and I'm going to put it at, I'm going to put it at x, and I'm going to put it at x plus 1. We're going to make life very easy. Okay? In real life, that might be you know, 5, 10, whatever is related to the velocity of the object. But here's the interesting thing. It's moved. Okay? That's where it was. It moved over by 1. What we're going to do is what's called a projection. This was a very clever person. Take the entire image, project it down onto the thing. Okay, and I'm going to make, for this, it really easy. Every pixel other than the object, 0, the object is 1. Same thing over here. So, what does your projection look like? That. Look like over here? That. That's where it was. It moved. Now, here's the real cleverness. Here's where 4 3 4. This is the spacing. This is the time between frames. And this is just an integer. Okay. Now, it moved over. I'm going to multiply it by, well, actually, I'm going to multiply it by the same thing, but x changed. Okay. Now, what does this thing look like? Okay. This is really cool. Euler's theorem. Okay, this looks like cosine and this is just motivation for what we're doing. The whole idea is moving objects generate sinusoids in the projection. Now that's actually sort of an amazing revelation. Would you have ever thought of that? I'll be honest, I wouldn't have, at least not for a long time. You know, this is not immediately obvious to think of multiplying it by that. Okay. And if you have a moving object, let's imagine now that it's moving at a constant velocity, and you just did a sequence of these projections, and you just summed up all the projections, why not just do a Fourier transform? You'd get all the velocities of all of the moving objects. That's really neat. So, look at this. There is the previous picture plotted vertically. Okay? And it turns out there's the very, very tiny moving object. You can barely see it. And what I want to know is what is the velocity of the moving object? I don't just want, you know, to find it. I want to know how fast it's moving. So it turns out if you do the projection and the Fourier transform of the projection, look at that. There's, since nothing else, since we sort of, you know, obviously, we added a moving object to a still picture, it's going to look as good as it possibly could. This is, and that's because we used a discrete Fourier transform, that's just the reflection. That tells us the frequency of the movement, and knowing the frequency, I can tell you the velocity. Isn't that impressive? That is a really clever algorithm. I don't know if you'll have a use for it. Say that again? You mean like the police detect how fast you're? Oh, there, we just do pulses. And in fact, if you want, I think I made a copy of the MythBusters episode on how to defeat police radar. They did an absolutely horrible lousy job. Hanging disco lights from the mirror. None of that stuff really works. There are simpler techniques. Just talk to anyone in the military. They know how to stealth vehicles. Well, they did. Actually, they did. They had a gun on the back of the car that shot out aluminum foil. But there's something simpler. There's a commercial product called Echozorb, used by anyone that works with radar. You can buy bras for your car made out of it from companies in Colorado. It absorbs microwaves. There are optical countermeasures. We call these, well, Bill probably knows all about these things, but there's ECM, and then there's countermeasures. It's a whole other world, but I don't want to talk about it. Okay, but what's really cool is, look at that. Look at how strong that velocity component is. That's unbelievable. You know, there's excellent signal to noise. It's just amazing. And the locations at the peaks, they correspond to, I threw that integer in here, and I can do these obviously in X and Y. I can do it horizontal velocity and a vertical velocity. And the relationship is simply that the frequency is equal to that constant times the velocity. So the velocity is just, I come over here, I measure the frequency. Wow, that looks like it's at 3. Okay. And I don't remember what A was. I think I may have picked it as 1. And so there's the velocity. This is great. It's a really powerful technique for measuring, well, first of all, detecting if there's anything moving, and then getting the velocity of it. There is one thing that I didn't give you with this algorithm. Where is the object? But we know how fast it's moving. This is a really neat algorithm, but be careful that you don't expect more out of it than it can deliver. Okay, but it's great for doing velocity. Okay. We finished 10. I think we will finish. Okay. By the way, Gorn, if you're feeling left out and want to do a vision project, we found some excellent vision projects for unmanned aerial vehicles on finding the horizons visually. And I found a couple papers on how do you find runways and landing strips and stuff. So if you need to include that in your dissertation, feel free. Okay. We're going to talk about now higher level stuff. Okay. What we want to do is we want to apply data compression to images. And I, you notice I said data compression. This is a little different than image compression. What I want to do is reduce objects to simple patterns, numbers, or collections of features. And I haven't exactly said what features are yet. But for example, one of the things is, can we come up with numbers that describe objects? Can we come up with numbers that describe objects independent of rotation? And that's sort of what's going to go on here. We're going to talk about something called chain codes. Okay? And a chain code is a method of writing numbers which describe the boundary of an object. And I don't mean by pixel location. They're completely different. What they are is they're the direction of each component. Okay? So if we have a four-direction chain code, that'll be direction 0. 1, 2, 3. We could have an 8-connected chain code. Basically, how many levels do you want in the slope or the direction? Okay? And what you do, and this is the one problem with the technique, normally when you run an edge operator, you get a whole bunch of edge points. Not good. Usually that's way, way, way too many. And the O's have XY coordinates associated with them. What you and this, by the way, is used for object recognition. You know, I might want to separate an SUV from a Corvette or something if I were looking at car silhouettes, or a 747 from a Piper Cherokee. You know, but we're looking at shapes. And usually the first thing we do is we resample on a regular grid. This, by the way, is a problem. How do you position the grid on an object to resample it? You know, one of the things that you could do is you could align it with it so that the top and the side are the same. This technique works very, very well. For example, if you have an overhead camera and you're inspecting parts going by on an assembly line, or if you're doing something in a manufacturing process, the object is always there. For the moment, if you rotate the object, it'll be completely different. So we will ignore rotation and scaling and stuff. We just want to talk about chain codes for a moment. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this and resample it. And I'm not going to get into all of the rules of resampling, but basically if we've got something close to a node of our resampling grid, we'll set that to 1. Otherwise, it'll be 0. So for example, we're close there, we'll put a 1 in the resampled grid. We're closer to the top than to the bottom, so we'll put that one in there. And you can see what we have is a much coarser now grid. Okay, we've lost some of the information, but imagine now that it's connected like this. You see these little arrows? They follow that object up there. And we have only these directions allowed. 0, 1, 2, 3. So we have to join all of the points on our resampled grid, okay, with those directions. And what we did is, if we do that, we'll get this object. And notice, every little arrow between each one of these grid points, okay, and sometimes, remember, I'm using a 4-direction chain code, I can't go like that. I have to decide in advance, will I go up and over or across and up? Okay, so there's some ambiguity. 4 codes are obviously coarse. A 8-direction chain code obviously looks like a better fit because it can handle angles. How big do you make the resampling grid, or rather I should say how fine do you make it? Depends on your problem. Don't know. Okay, there's all kinds of other things you can do. They relate to resampling. Okay, let's just lay a grid down over our object, and we found a boundary. Okay, canny operator, watershed algorithm, whatever. We lay this regular grid down, and we only the rectangle have a boundary in it. Okay, this is sort of a minimum energy technique. Now, imagine that this boundary is a rubber band and it stretches. Basically, it goes into the lowest energy state. And there are ways of writing computer programs to make things go to lowest energy states. And you notice how it stretches and it fits. And that's basically called a minimum perimeter polygon. You can do all kinds of interesting things. This one's a little bit different. Okay, this is basically boundary segments. Take the 2 points, which are the farthest apart in the object, draw a line between them. Then find the maximum perpendiculars on each side of that line. Okay, those 2 points. okay, you can immediately connect those and form a polygon that you can say approximates the object. Now, the thing is that a good representation? It depends on how coarse, how rough the boundary is. What you may have to do is, and this is what's typically done to determine when you stop with this algorithm, what you do is you take, for example, segment AC here. You measure the perpendicular distance. If that is above a threshold, what you do is you go along and find the maximum deviation point, add a new point, and then you'd have another segment on the boundary like that. Okay? So basically, you're taking a complicated object, you're going to reduce it to a couple lines. Hopefully a couple. Okay? Signatures. Okay? There's all kinds of ways of doing signatures. What this is imagine I have a color coordinate system. There is a circle. I just plot R as a function of theta. That is a signature. It tells me how the shape varies. This could be for any arbitrary object, the center. Maybe we take the centroid, you know, the average in X and Y. Okay. Notice what happens if you do it with a rectangle. You get a different signature. So there are ways now of representing complicated, complex objects. I'm not going to go too far because I remembered to bring the course surveys today and I want to get those things done. Remember convex hulls? One way of coding an object is by something called the convex deficiency. So here's the boundary of an object. There's the convex hull. We might have found it by image morphology, like from chapter 9. Okay. Every place that the boundary goes through the convex hull right there. Okay. Let me back up and put it this way. There's the convex hull. The difference between the object and the convex hull is called the convex deficiency. Anytime the boundary, see here, there's no convex deficiency. It comes up, and right there, it goes into a convex deficiency. So the places where it changes, those get worse, and that's the boundary. So there's all kinds of cool ways of doing things. Our skeleton comes back to haunt us. We should have done this one at Halloween. But this is known as the median axis transform, MAT. And remember what we did in Chapter 9 is we put the ball inside that it touches at two points. What we're doing is, what we do is we take a point and we find it. And now the median is the set of points that have equidistant nearest neighbors. That makes pretty good sense. So here, closest neighbor would be there and there. They're not equal. That's not in our set. Here, they're equal. So that's in our set. And you can come down here and you can see I can do distances and they're perpendicular distances, okay? And they're equal. So I can, and notice if I have little protrusions, it'll follow in. So the median axis transformation is a little bit different. It's based upon distance, whereas the skeleton algorithm that we did before was based upon topology. A little bit different. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. We're going to get into really cool stuff next time. Because we're going to do eigenvectors and eigenvalues. Those of you who have read about doing facial recognition, that's how it's done, an eigenvector analysis. Don't worry. You don't have to really know what how you really compute eigenvectors. There's a routine in MATLAB which does it for you. What you need to know is mathematically, they're a hoteling transformation, which lets you do data reduction to features. Eigenvectors are really cool. They are the principal features. So, I have these for you. I'm supposed to leave as soon as I give these to you. Anyone want to volunteer to take them back? I know, someone... Okay. I don't know how it works. And if anyone wants a pencil, we have lots of pencils. Well, maybe not many. We have some pencils. And let's see. Please choose a student. John, you volunteered? I'll give you the instructions then. You can read them.
Who hasn't done this?
Okay. And I'm going to pack up my stuff.